The headlines this hour: the southern Iranian city of Bandar Abbas witnesses a ceremony welcoming the Navy's 86th flotilla back home after a mission around the world. Meanwhile, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces tells Press TV that the flotilla accomplished its mission despite U.S. threats and pressures. And people in Greece head to the polls in the general elections overshadowed by a cost of living crisis and a train disaster in February. Thanks for joining us. An official ceremony has been held in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of a naval flotilla back home after a successful journey around the world. The ceremony was attended by top military commanders, including the Chief of General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces. Major General Mohammad Bagheri said at the ceremony that the expedition marks the beginning of a new chapter in the growth of Iran's naval power. The general added that the mission is a unique achievement for a navy subject to sanctions and other propaganda and pressure. The flotilla comprised the domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Makran forward-based ship. They entered Iranian waters on May 17. The flotilla completed a 63,000-kilometer journey around the Earth in 8 months. It marked the first time an Iranian naval group entered the Pacific. The vessels sailed to South America and visited South Africa before returning home. We were earlier joined by our correspondent, Gisumi Shahmadi, who gave us more details about the flotilla's unique world voyage. Let's take a listen to what she has to say.
I am at the port city of Bandar Abbas in the south of Iran. The 86th flotilla is back from its round-the-world trip, a very specific and special experience for the Iranian Navy. Let's mention that not all navies in the world have this type of experience, touring the entire world, traveling through all the major oceans, the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, some very dangerous maritime routes that they've passed, and of course, this is all done because of the technical development of the Iranian Navy, the fact that it has acquired state-of-the-art know-how and technology in order to be able to carry out such an important and dangerous, in many cases, mission that not all navies, as I mentioned before, would be able to take on, traveling through all the important and major canals in the world. And, of course, let's also point out to the fact that this was done because of an atmospherology software that was developed by Iranian technicians. Now, to find out more about the technical aspects and the major developments in this field, I am joined by the technical commander of the Iranian Navy, who is joining me right now to tell us more about this.
The all-Iranian Dena destroyer and the Makran forward-based ship are the result of round-the-clock efforts by technical experts at the Iranian Navy and the Defense Ministry, and they managed to pass through all this long route. It is almost 60,000 kilometers they sailed across that route, and that suggests the technical progress of our youth. With the help of this software, we were able to predict what would happen in the seas, and this was one of the secrets to our success, and we knew what we were supposed to do.
Well, a correspondent also asked the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, about the U.S. pressure campaign against the flotilla. This is what he had to say.
Tell us about the U.S. The U.S. had threatened countries, had asked countries not to allow the Iranian flotilla, the Iranian warships, to dock in their countries. However, we saw that despite U.S. threats, countries like Brazil did not heed the U.S. threats, and also some sanctions had been imposed on this flotilla. The 8-month voyage by this flotilla around the world showed that we can, with reliance on our own capabilities, we can be present in any place in the world, in the oceans around the world, wherever the maritime law allows us to. So we docked at 5 ports during this voyage. The U.S. tried to threaten those countries and ask them not to allow the Iranian warships to dock there, but it didn't happen, and the U.S. should accept that the leverage that it shows, that it uses in the world, those levers are losing their power, are waning, and countries are trying to remain independent, and countries want to decide about their own future. You are seeing these developments in countries in the southern part of the Persian Gulf, and our flotilla, you saw that docked in those countries. U.S. threats are, in fact, threadbare threats. They are saying that they have just kept themselves alive by making these threats. They want to create the impression that they are the masters of the world, and the U.S. wants just to create the impression that it remains a master and a world power.
Well, the spokesperson of Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Nasser Kanani, says the mission of the Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla indicates that the U.S. sanctions against Iran can be broken.
Iran, during this major mission, showed that cruel sanctions by the U.S. Can be broken, and this mission rekindled hope in the hearts of independent nations around the world, and told countries which are going to wean themselves off the dependence of major powers that through national might they can actually break the obstacles of the world hegemony. This move by Iran rekindled hope in nations, in friendly nations and countries. Also, it increased Iran's national dignity, and we thank God Almighty for that. Our brave personnel, I mean naval personnel, we congratulate them all on this, and we are confident that this move will definitely tip the balance of international equations, including in international naval arena, in Iran's favor. And the enemies should take into consideration this fact.
Political analyst Alexander Azargan described the voyage as a great achievement for the country.
86th Fleet just came to Bandar Abbas. It was comprised of the forward-based ship Macron, as well as the domestically manufactured destroyer Dena. I must emphasize the fact that domestically manufactured technology, this is very important. This is a result of many years of cooperation between Iran's foreign ministry and Iranian universities and Iran's other military-industrial complex apparatus. It is a great moment for Iran, to project an image of power, most importantly to the Iranian people themselves, who, after many years of monstrous economic aggression and sanctions, are feeling proud of their nation. Only a handful of countries can achieve this. As Misu was mentioning, 63,000 kilometers around the world, 8 months, a journey across three oceans. And in my opinion, this is Iran's yes, we can, and yes, we did moment. If I could make an advisory note, I would strongly urge the Iranians to follow up this achievement with another voyage going to the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which is one of the three most straits in the whole world, Strait of Hormuz, Bab al-Mandab, and Strait of Malacca, and have them go through the Red Sea, go through the Suez Canal, and send a strong message to the Israelis, who now have submarine presence in the Sea of Oman. They don't dare go through the Strait of Hormuz to be in the Persian Gulf, which the IRGC is protecting, but Iran needs to send a strong message.
At least 6 Iranian border guards have been killed in a terrorist attack in the southeast of the country. The incident took place in the Saravan region of Sistan and Balochistan province. Border guards engaged in armed clashes with terrorists trying to cross into Iran. The terrorists, however, were pushed back across the border after suffering deadly losses. Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province shares a long border with Pakistan and has seen several terrorist attacks targeting both civilians and security forces. Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound once again, further fueling anti-Israeli sentiments. The controversial move comes 3 days after the politician, along with tens of thousands of Israeli extremists, marched through the occupied Old City of Al-Quds and just over a week into a fragile Gaza ceasefire. With tensions flaring up in the occupied Palestinian territories, he said that Israel is in charge of Al-Quds. Meanwhile, Hamas announced in a statement that the Israeli regime will be responsible for the consequences of the presence of Ben-Gvir and settlers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Mona Condil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more about this. Well, tell us more about the visit and, of course, what kind of reactions there have been to it.
Well, this morning, Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, and he issued a brief statement from there claiming that during the visit that he's so happy to enter the complex, describing it, as they call it, as the Temple Mount, and said that the threats of Hamas movement will not change anything, claiming that the Israeli authorities and the Israeli occupation will always be the masters of Al-Quds and the entire land of Israel, and that the complex there is owned by the Israelis. Immediately, a statement issued by the spokesman of the Palestinian Authority, Nabil Abu Dena, calling on the raid by Ben-Gvir as a flagrant attack on Al-Aqsa, and he also warned that it would have serious repercussions. He said that the raid of Ben-Gvir, describing him as an extremist minister at the early hour like thieves, into the Al-Aqsa Mosque Square will impose, will not change reality and will not impose Israeli sovereignty. The Foreign Ministry of Jordan also issued a statement condemning the raid of Ben-Gvir in the strongest terms, calling it a dangerous and unacceptable escalation and a flagrant as well as unacceptable violation of the international law, and said that the sovereignty over Al-Aqsa and that no other party had any rightful claim but the Palestinians as well as the Jordanians there. Hamas movement also issued a statement saying the Hamas movement will not leave Al-Aqsa alone, and warned that Israel will bear responsibility for the barbaric incursions of its ministers and herds of settlers. The raid of Ben-Gvir to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex comes only 3 days after the Israelis and the Jewish settlers celebrated the so-called flag march on Thursday. That was when the Israelis celebrate the occupation of the eastern part of Al-Quds. Unfortunately, over 1,500 settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Thursday with the protection of the Israeli police. The Palestinians today are warning that Ben-Gvir is trying to provoke the Palestinians, is trying to impose more facts on ground. But at the same time, the Palestinians are united today, and they are urging the international community and the world to force the Israeli regime, mainly Ben-Gvir himself, to force him not to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, because this would drag the whole region into a religious war. We have to mention that what's going on comes only after a ceasefire had been reached between the Palestinian resistance group of the Jihad movement in Gaza Strip and Israel that led to the killing of over 30 Palestinians in the Israeli airstrikes. When Palestinian resistance groups fired hundreds of rockets on the occupied territories. If these acts would continue, according to Palestinians, then the Israeli regime itself would be dragging the whole region into another war.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Monica Ndil from Occupied Ramallah. On to Greece, polling stations there have opened in a general election overshadowed by a cost of living crisis. The ruling New Democracy Party, headed by Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis, is leading the opinion polls. However, a cost of living crisis and a train disaster in February have made it hard for the party to garner the needed votes. The left-wing Syriza party, chaired by the former premier Alexis Tsipras, is the main rival to the ruling party. Nearly 10 million people are eligible to vote. Meanwhile, changes to the electoral rules have reduced the party's chances to obtain the absolute majority. The party ranking first needs over 45% of the electorate to secure the majority in the 300-seat parliament. Concerns are on the rise in Afghanistan over the high level of poverty, with children withstanding the worst of its consequences. As Abdullah Mirzada reports from Kabul, many children are working to take a morsel home while facing malnutrition and exclusion from school.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these puddles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Mirzada, Kabul.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within the space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just
but
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful. careful with it tied like on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look and then they can read the stories.
I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to, yeah, it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like, exactly. Even you can play devil's advocate, these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together in the code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A
state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
the difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against civilian unrest, and I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and the next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I
was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, lives, the brown lives, if Black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many Black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود باعث تو لو اتمم مکارم الاخلاق.
The Holy
Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is For a Better Life from IRB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkul. Let's be with me for another topic related to Islamic lifestyle and to see how it can help us enjoy a better Islamic life based on the Quran and Islamic narrations. The subject of my discussion is a general topic that I only want to touch a part of that. And the subject is that we should be wary about divine punishment. This is, as I said, the general topic that people should always be cautious. Be cautious not to disobey Allah. There is an undeniable fact in people's life that Allah does not leave the disobedient and unruly people alone. Of course, Allah will give anyone a chance to repent, a fortune to realize the reality, and will give him a time to correct himself. But it is not the basic custom of Allah to always forgive, to always dismiss, and to repeatedly overlook the ugly things that sinners do. Allah, next to being affectionate, next to being merciful, His punishment is also severe, and His chastisement is also deeply painful. This is a general topic that is discussed so much, and so many verses of the Quran talks about the punishment of Allah. Allah will punish the disobedient both in this world and in the hereafter. As I said, this is a general topic, but in my discussion, I want to restrict it to an example and to highlight a specific example of it. Sometimes people get involved in doing something that Allah has prohibited. I mean, they commit sins or do something that they are not allowed by Allah to do that. But even though that they commit the sin, they do not see any sign of the divine punishment, any sign of Allah's anger, nothing to make them aware of divine wrath. Rather, these sinful people still benefit from the divine blessings, and they see that their lives are good and ideal. Some people who are not aware of the reality, when they see these abundant and continuous blessings, and that their life is ideal and normal, they interpret it in the wrong way. They think that their sin is not that much important, or that Allah is too much forgiving. And even worse than that, they totally forget that they are committing sins. And as a result, sin will become a part of their normal life. But in reality, they would be being exposed to a divine punishment, a punishment that are still becoming more painful and more rigorous. A punishment that as people repeat committing sins continuously, that punishment is also becoming more painful and painful. This is what Allah says in the Quran. أَفَأَمِنُوا مَكْرَ اللَّهِ Do the sinners feel secure against the punishing plans of Allah? Then Allah says, فَلَا يَأْمَنُ مَكْرَ اللَّهِ إِلَّا الْقَوْمُ الْخَاسِرُونَ Whereas no one feels secure against Allah's punishment, save the losers. Allah uses the word loser because those people who think that Allah does not punish them, they feel that they are secure from any harm, they are safe from any hazardous outcome. So they keep repeating their sins, and the burden of their sins becomes heavier and heavier. And then their distance from God increases, and the divine punishment becomes more severe, and their deprivation of Allah's blessing becomes more and more. Let's go for a short break. I am Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkul, and I will be back to talk about this scenario more. Yeah. I was saying that sometimes sinners ignore a very important fact in their life. They continuously repeat a sin or sort of sins. They disobey Allah, and still they do not see any sign of God's punishment. They do not see any sign of God's displeasure in their lives. As a result, they think that everything is in its place and everything is just fine. But since they are not aware of the world of the unseen and they are not informed of what is taking place behind the scenes, they would be exposed to a very rigorous divine punishment. But they who are unaware of everything are busy with their normal and sinful life. Sometimes God even increases his blessing to such people, to such sinful people. But the reason for this is that when Allah suddenly withdraws these blessings from these sinful people, and when Allah deprives them, the severity of this deprivation and the pain of Allah's divine punishment will be more severe and more intense. Imam Ali, in one of his noble narrations, points to this fact and says, Yabna Adam, O the son of Adam, إِذَا رَأَيْتَ رَبَّكَ سُبْحَانَهُ يُطَابِعُ عَلَيْكَ نِعْمَةً. When you see that your Lord, the Glorified, bestows His favor upon you, وَأَنْتَ تَعْصِيَهُ, while you are disobeying Him, فَحْذَرُهُ, you should fear Him. You should fear Allah. The Imam means that when someone disobeys Allah repeatedly, but sees that Allah's blessings are still abundant, Allah's bounty in his life are still plentiful. This is an alarm that a wise man should be very fearful about it. A wise man should know that it is not normal. It is not normal that Allah gives his blessing to someone who is disobeying him. A wise person should quickly think that these blessings that God gives him while he is sinful could be among those blessings that God gives to the sinners, so then suddenly takes them back and replaces them with divine punishment. As a result, the sinner would be left with a total deprivation. A wise man should be very fearful about that. An intellectual man has to know that if Allah gives blessing after blessings to the sinners, Allah must have actually helped the sinners to commit sin. Why Allah should give blessing to the sinners? It is not compatible with the intellect that someone commits a sin and God increases his blessing on him. As a result, if someone commits a lot of sins but does not see any adverse feedback from God in his life, this is actually the alarm bell that may sound sooner or later in his life. These blessings can be a dangerous sign in his life. As the commander of the faithful Imam Ali has mentioned in the above narration, a person should be extremely afraid of it, and he should totally fear God. The sinful man would suddenly be ambushed by divine forces, and then he would find nowhere to get out safely. It is a sign of ignorance for a person to imagine that God only deals with his servants with mercy and will easily forgive the sinners. It is not the fact. Yes, of course, Allah easily forgives, Allah easily overlooks, grants forgiveness. But for those who want to correct their behavior and correct their ugly actions, Allah is merciful for those who regret when they think about their sins. But Allah does not easily forgive the sin of those who think committing sin is not that much important. Those who think to have haram and forbidden pleasure is not that much abhorrent and detestable. These people who think if they disobey Allah, it is not important, they're actually underestimating the high position of God. When someone does not honor the important position of Allah, and when Allah is not important in his vision, why should they be important in the vision of God? As a result, those blessings that are given to the sinners, is a sign of a future rigorous punishment. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.